This is an ABC podcast.
This is The Conversation Hour with Jonathan Kendall on ABC Radio.
Now, we tackle some pretty thorny issues on The Conversation Hour, but on this one, I've been warned by a friend and a colleague to tread very carefully and that I should not make any assumptions today. And the sensitive topic we're wading into today is water. Now, water, of course, vital for all life, but in Australia, it can be traded in largely the same way as wool, sugar, oil, or fava beans. So why does water security matter? Well, on a drying continent, it's about the survival of, well, all of us, farming communities in particular. It's about your grocery bill. It's about public expenditure. The Murray-Darling Basin Plan will cost taxpayers $13 billion. And what makes it so political? And who should have a say in how our water is managed? Taxpayers, irrigators, hedge funds, First Nations people. What do you think? 1-300-222-774. We spoke a bit about the pressure on waterways last week. We ran out of time, though, to speak about the largest and most complex river system in Australia, the Murray-Darling. And that river system covers 1 million square kilometres of southeastern Australia. And the plan that covers it was a really hot topic in federal parliament last week when the Nationals tried to reduce the amount of environmental flows into the Murray. So how did we get to this point where water has been so politicised? The point where professional traders, brokers and hedge funds buy and sell water just for profit, and where water is traded like any other commodity.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio.
This is an attack from the water terrorists of the coalition.
We've got the National Party in here moving amendments to gut the Murray Duck Basin Plan against the will of their coalition partners.
And that was Greens Senator Sarah Hanson-Young speaking there in Parliament last week about some moves from the Nationals to try and change the water flowing through the Murray-Darling Basin. Clint Jasper is an ABC rural reporter and has been following this pretty closely. Good morning, Clint.
Howdy, Jono.
What did you make of all that discussion last week in federal Parliament about something as serious as flows down the Murray?
There were many layers to it, and I guess one of the overwhelming senses I had was how disappointing it was, because yet again, a conversation about water, a serious conversation about how we take steps to getting more water security in the basin, dissolved into quite an unedifying political display in Canberra, which it so often does. One of the most interesting things is one of the things that the Nationals was trying to say is that 450 billion litres, the 450 gigalitres that you referred to of environmental water that under the basin plan are supposed to come on top of the rest of the savings, were functionally already dead. That's already been taken off the table by New South Wales and Victoria back in 2018, I believe, when they said that none of those projects designed to deliver that water could be approved if they had any negative social or economic impact on communities in the river, which, I mean, there's no project that can do that. So the states killed it, and what the Nationals were trying to do is just kind of recognise that it wasn't going to happen.
Okay, so why should someone listening to this today, why should they pay attention to what's happening in the Murray-Darling Basin and the plan that's supposed to govern it?
Not only is that water drinking water for everyone who lives along the Murray and quite extensively either side of it, right into South Australia and a significant portion of Adelaide's drinking water, but this is a $13 billion reform. I'm not sure how many people would remember, but it was during the millennium drought, something that captured national attention. We just had a drought, and under the, water recovery to date, we were able to keep the water flowing from, you know, Hume Dam and the mountains up the top all the way through to the lower lakes. Now, that caused a lot of pain along the way. We had the protest at Parliament House. But, you know, to a certain extent, the plan is working. We have recovered water and all of us have paid for it. It's a $13 billion reform that, comes out of our tax dollars. The federal government gives money to the states to kind of enact this plan. And in that area as well, a lot of food is grown. Stone fruit, rice, a lot of citrus in Mildura, almonds. There's lots and lots of produce, as well as livestock that is produced in the Murray-Darling Basin. It's a really rich food bowl that, you know, we see a lot of it on the shelves at the supermarket, and we send a lot of it overseas, where overseas communities, overseas customers pay top dollar for produce that they regard as the best in the world.
So everyone should be caring about what's happening in the Murray-Darling Basin, because it is just so huge and has an effect on so many people. More than 2.6 million Australians call the Murray-Darling Basin home, and it produces $24 billion worth of food and fibre every year. So if you've got expensive water for agriculture, then that's going to force up prices at the supermarket, isn't it, Clint?
Yeah, it has all sorts of impacts. You know, there's the raw price of the water year to year, which will change from depending on how much rain there is. We saw prices at the end of the drought spiking at, you know, levels, I think it was like $171 a megalitre. I might have that number wrong. You know, the second it started raining, it was back down below 100. You know, the price just drops off, because if you're getting it free from the sky, you don't need to buy it out of the river, essentially. And, you know, this uncertainty around water and water ownership. Take one example. I believe it's, 40%, I think, of dairy farms along the Upper Murray in Victoria are now no longer there. Now, there's been some huge dramas in the dairy industry, but when you're comparing the, I guess, stress and cost of production with this variable water price changing year to year compared to somewhere like being a dairy farmer in Warrnambool around that southwest where you just get nice, beautiful rainfall every day, you know, that's just driving people from the industry because of the uncertainty and the cost associated with producing what a product that, you know, what you get for your milk is quite fixed, but what it costs to produce it jumps all around all the time.
We are talking about water and what makes it so political. Who should have a say in how it's managed? And how did we get to this point where, as we're talking with Clint Jasper from ABC Rural, where in Parliament last week, there was the Nationals trying to, well, kind of break away from their policy that they'd agreed on with the Liberals to do with the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. This is a little bit of what Senator Simon Birmingham said on the Murray-Darling Basin Plan last week.
The government stands resolute in its support for the implementation of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, for implementation, as we have said, in full and on time. We are proud as a government to have ensured that billions, thousands of billions of litres of additional water entitlement have been secured to support environmental flows across the Murray-Darling Basin. The securing of those thousands of billions of litres of additional water entitlement is enabling the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder to undertake a range of activities in support of environmental assets across the Murray-Darling Basin.
That's South Australian Senator Simon Birmingham speaking in federal parliament last week about some potential changes to the Murray-Darling Basin plan. Now, Clint Jasper, what did you make of that? It's been described as the Nationals' ideas being slapped down, but is that fair?
Yeah, well, essentially it was. Basically, again, going back in history, to get this plan over the line, it was, you know, a rare show of bipartisanship. It was the Liberal part or the Coalition and Labor coming together in recognition of the fact that the river was over-extracted at the time. And we saw some really nasty effects of that during the drought. You could walk across the Murray River in parts of South Australia. It got so low. And so you do have this steely determination from the Liberal and Labor Party in particular to see this plan all the way through. That's why you hear them quite often saying on time and in full, and that means they're going to, you know, recover the full 2,750 gigalitres of water from agriculture and return it to the environment by the end of the plan. Now, they've already done the vast bulk of that work. I think we're up to 2,100 ish gigalitres recovered. So a lot has been taken, but they've left the last part of it rather than buy the water back from farmers as a series of quite complex projects designed to deliver the same kind of environmental outcomes. And this is where we're getting a lot of the fuzziness and confusion towards the end of the line.
Rhys is joining us now. Rhys, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Glenarua, and the biggest issue they have with the Murray-Darling Basin is that they want to keep taking water out for irrigation and water for the environment and then water for all the towns along the way. They want to increase the population of the major towns along the river, yet there's no new additional water going into the system. So it doesn't matter how you cut the pie, if you don't increase the water, you can't give any more away to people.
Well, this seems to be the problem, Clint, and thank you for your call, Lee. This seems to be the problem. This is dealing up an ever-diminishing pie, and there's just not enough water. Is that what this comes down to, Clint?
Well, I'm interested. That's a different perspective from what I normally hear, because if you speak to some of the more angry farmers who'd like to see the basin plan ripped up, they would tell you that the basin plan is, you know, a strategy by stealth to depopulate the basin. It's interesting that some people think that there's this effort underway to, you know, get more people living along there, when a lot of the farmers would say that the course of the basin plan has had quite the opposite effect, driving people out of the region.
How did water become so politicised in Australia? Matt is in Fairfield. Good morning, Matt. What's your point?
Oh, good morning. Clint put his finger on it earlier when he mentioned the types of crops that are grown. I mean, rice and almonds, we're exporting water. And you've got, to answer your question about how politics and water became combined, you've got a big player like Cubby Station and the big donations that come in to continue their allocation. I mean, why are we growing cotton in Australia, for heaven's sake?
Thank you, Matt, for your thoughts. Clint, what do you say to that? Because that's a pretty common opinion. And I know the cotton growers and the rice growers will say, we only, you know, put a crop in when we've got enough water to be able to get it out. So what do you say to those people who say we just shouldn't be growing, you know, cotton and rice in Australia?
I think this is the first year that Cubby Station has produced a crop. For many of the years before that, during the drought, its paddocks were dry. It didn't take an allocation from the rivers that feed it. There was essentially no rice grown in Australia, but for, I think, the 3 years leading up to 2019, because all of those farmers were on very low or zero allocation. And I'm just confused about the exporting water as well, because, you know, there's water in the wool we send overseas. There's water in the wheat that we send overseas that falls from the sky. What else are we doing with this water that, you know, belongs to farmers? It's for agriculture. So, you know, you can debate the merits of whether we need almonds or not, but in a country that produces so much food in excess of what we actually consume domestically, you know, you'd be singling out one commodity, and I think going down a path of telling people what they can and can't grow gets pretty hairy.
It does. It does. Sam Birrell is with the Committee for Greater Shepparton. Sam, you're after a bit of extra clarity on the Murray-Darling Basin plan. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I think it often gets, when I listen to this issue discussed in the metropolitan media, with yourself excepted, because I think Clint's done a really good job of explaining it, people seem to think that the basin communities want no water to go to the environment and the farmers want it all. And it's really not the case. A huge amount, as Clint explained, a huge amount of water has been extracted already from communities such as this one, and Shepparton's economy has suffered as a result, and we've diversified out a bit. But more or less, we've been okay to see some of that water go to the environment. The arguments over that last 450 gigalitres, which was an add-on to the basin plan that South Australia said that they wouldn't sign the plan unless they got that extra 450. That extra 450 has to be on the proviso that it doesn't hurt basin communities, but some people want it anyway. And that's what we're arguing over. So I think, you know, it's not a sort of a farmers versus environment issue necessarily. It's just over that last issue. And another thing I'd say just in relation to politicisation is that the National's federal position is in lockstep with state Labor, the Victorian government's position. So it's not so much along party lines, it's more along sort of probably where you are.
And what's your position, Sam? Do you think that extra 450 gigalitres going to the environment, so going to environmental flows, would that have a negative impact on your community?
In two ways it would have a negative impact. Most of that water is supposed to go to South Australia, And in order to get it down there, and most of it would come from here because we've got the most secure water products in Victoria and in the Goulburn system, most of it would come from here. So not only does that water go to South Australia and take, you know, irrigation opportunities away and therefore damage our food producing industries, it also turns the Goulburn River into a huge channel to be able to get it down there. So the Goulburn River's got to run higher than it normally would at the wrong time of year to get that water down there. So we're concerned doubly on an environmental, in an environmental way, but also an economic way. We don't want to see our precious Goulburn River become a channel for an environmental outcome desired further down the basin.
I think one thing that we're seeing in the basin at the moment and in all water communities is this desire or this realisation that some of the things that were tightly screwed down in the plan 10 or so years ago when all of this was being determined aren't really playing out as they expected, first and foremost because climate change was never considered as part of the, or was never considered in the plan's modelling. And there's dawning realisation that the river can't be treated like a pipeline and everybody, the environment included, might be having to plan for a future with less water.
Pretty clear message there from Sam. Thank you for your time, Sam, from the Committee for Greater Shepparton. Let's bring Professor Quinton Grafton from the ANU. He's a public policy expert into the conversation, and he's a convener of the Water Justice Hub and the director of the Centre for Water Economics, Environment and Policy at the Australian National University. G'day there.
Oh, hi, John. Hi, Clint. And hello to your listeners.
And we just heard from a caller, Lee, that was before our last caller, Sam. Lee was saying that towns need more water if we want population growth along the Murray. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, towns certainly need water, and they need water of a sufficiently high enough quality. And so if you go to places like Wilcannia, Menindee, and other places in the Lower Darling and the Northern Basin during the last drought, you would have seen that they didn't have any water that was fit to drink or even bathe in. So clearly we've got problems, and it's not just because of droughts. It's because we're over-extracting the amount of water, at least in the upper parts of our system, and it's having negative consequences on communities. So if you're living in a place like Wilcannia and you can't drink your water and you can't even go for a shower, then you can certainly know that there's a real water emergency going on and you want that fixed and you want your governments to help you to fix that.
And Sam was saying there from the Committee for Shepparton, he was saying that this isn't an environment versus agriculture debate. It's not that simple, and that farmers quite often do agree with environmental flows. It's just that that wasn't necessarily, you know, written into the agreement that they would get that environmental flow if it didn't negatively affect communities like Shepparton. So what do you think?
Look, a lot of irrigators do the right thing. A lot of irrigators care about their communities and they care about the environment. So it's not about anti-irrigators, but it has to be stated categorically that irrigation, so it's the nature of the sector, the industry, takes about 70% of the water extractions in the Murray-Darling Basin. And it consumes a higher proportion of that, maybe 85%. So in terms of water extractions and water consumption, irrigation is by far the most important factor above everything else. So if we are to get sustainable agriculture, sustainable environment, sustainable communities, whatever you want to add to the end of sustainable, we're going to need to be able to get water allocations that actually meet a whole range of different needs and services. And that's part of what we're trying to do with the Basin Plan. Now, part of the Basin Plan agreement, when that came in November 2012, that went through federal parliament, there was an agreement there would be an additional 450 gigalitres, that's 450 billion litres a year, that would go flowing into South Australia. And that was needed to get South Australia on board because they didn't believe there were sufficient allocations for the environment in the Basin Plan. So that was the agreement in 2012. Fast forward, I think it's 2018. There was a change in terms of how that 450 billion litres is to be delivered, and there's this test about no socioeconomic disadvantage test on those communities where that water is supposedly coming from. Remember, it's not the communities, it's the rivers themselves that are generating the water. So that's the nature of the test that's been put in, which makes it, in my view, virtually impossible to provide that water downstream to South Australia. So that's a problem for South Australia. It's a problem for in terms of making sure this whole agreement continues to work. But I think it's a problem more generally because, as I highlighted in Rock Canyon, Menindee in 2019, but it's other communities as well, and we can point to our wetlands, the degrading, the number of birds, million fish deaths in January 2019. I mean, we can point to a number of things, flows at the Murray Mouth, that we're not delivering what the Water Act asked us to deliver in 2007, and is not delivering what the Basin Plan said it was going to deliver. So we clearly have a problem, and we have to resolve this problem. We can't pretend it doesn't exist. We can't pretend that somehow we can kick this can down the road forever.
Quinton, yes, I was just wondering, do you see the path to resetting that kind of balance of consumption and extraction as, you know, simply removing the licenses from that side of the ledger, or a more judicious approach to things like embargoes and when pumping can occur and things like that?
It's a combination of both. So we have water sharing plans, particularly in the northern part of the Murray-Darling Basin, that just don't make any sense. We saw that in the 2017 ABC program Four Corners with massive, massive pumping taking place. And those rules, by the way, were changed in 2012 to actually allow for much larger pumping to take place. We have a Water Management Act in New South Wales, which gives priority to communities, yet communities are running dry because there's too much extraction upstream. So clearly we've got to get our planning right, particularly in New South Wales, but not exclusively in New South Wales. We also found out there was water theft occurring. That was again alleged in the TV program, subsequently found to be correct. Now we have a natural resource assessment regulator in New South Wales, so that's on the cards. And we also have a whole set of other issues in terms of we need to know in real time what's happening to the water, how it's being extracted and what's being used. So those are the sorts of things that have to happen. And as well, we need to have more stream flows. That's the bottom line. Without more stream flows, we're not going to get our environment or our communities back to where they need to be.
Well, look, thank you so much for your expertise, Professor Quinton Grafton from the ANU, the Australian National University, speaking there about what he thinks needs to happen. For lots of questions on the text line, this one says, why do we grow rice where we don't have adequate water? And when you talk to rice growers, I mean, they're quick to say, we don't grow rice when we don't have enough water. But what do you think about that? There's lots more text here, and I'll get to some of them in a little bit. First, to talk back, Jan is in the Upper Goulburn. Morning, Jan. What's your position?
Morning. Yes, look, climate change has a lot to do with why this water, specifically the 450 gigalitres, cannot be recovered. But most importantly, it cannot be delivered down the system. And politicians need to acknowledge and recognise this. We had in 2016 a flood which it exactly simulated what the proposed flows were to be to the South Australia with this 450 gigalitres. And that was 80,000 to the South Australian border for 5 weeks, which hopefully was going to scour the Murray Mouth and keep it open without dredging. Well, it didn't really achieve that. All it did was have huge flooding impacts. And to get the quantity of water they are talking about down the river with the 450 gigalitres will cause major flooding impacts, which brings into play the associated relaxed constraint strategy by which they wish to flood in excess of 3,000 landowners on a continuing basis. Now, this is flooding prime agricultural land. It can't be achieved. You know, the fact is that they keep saying we'll have the Basin Plan in full and on time. It will not be achieved in full on and on time because...
Well, see, this will be the really interesting thing to see, because you're right, Jan. They do say that the politicians are quite quick to say that it will be implemented in full and on time. Thank you for your call. Robert is in central Victoria and works in agriculture. Morning, Robert.
G'day, how are you going?
Very well. What are your thoughts?
Well, I've heard this point touched on a couple of times, and I really think, I'm not working agriculture anymore. I work in the aviation industry in Queensland, particularly with cotton. And I got the opportunity to fly over Queensland quite a bit. And I remember one day in particular, I was standing on this massive farm. It was owned by a multinational. And every drop of rain that fell on that property was captured and stored. And I said, and this is when the days of, licensing your water tank on your farm was coming in and you were being charged for overland flow. I said, how does this work at this place? It's massive. You'd drive 2 hours across the property and not cross a fence. It was just all cotton, massive, massive, massive multinational property. And they said, the budget of this company, it's more than the Queensland government's budget. They don't dare fight them. So they were capturing every drop of overland of water and pumping it through a system of channels and dams into this massive dam to use for irrigation. That was water that was not going into the system. That's the core of the problem.
Yeah, so it's about capturing water, but is it also about crop choice as well, Robert?
Well, maybe we should start growing hemp. It's a far better fibre and doesn't require anywhere near as much chemical or water. But hemp has got its own issues, particularly with the older generations. The Russian hemp fibre, you can smoke that till you get emphysema and you won't get a high out of it. It
hasn't Robert.
But there's so many issues. But I think the core of it is we need to start looking at what's not making it into the system, not so much of what we're taking out of it. People call these people irrigators. A lot of these people are food producers.
Yeah, good point.
And we should look at alternatives, as well. It's a multifaceted issue. But
there it is. It really is a multifaceted issue. Thank you so much, Robert, for your thoughts. And now, who have we got here? This is Howard. Good morning, Howard.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Righto. I think when you talk about the basin plan, a bit of history probably helps. First of all, there was 4 gigalitres of environmental water available to do all the massive sites from the Barmamillawa right through to Chowella in South Australia. That's quite inadequate. There's barely enough to manage them now. Historically, instead of attacking broad communities to get water, they should have had a broad brush 3 or 4% across out of all irrigators' licence. And at the same time, the federal government should have instituted a structural adjustment package which was going to help the communities because they didn't do the percentage in the first place. So if you go to, and Clinton Grafton covered it very well when he said the problem we have now is the Barwon Darling, which is a New South Wales arm, is affected by what's happened in Queensland, which has been ratified by the MDBA, unfortunately, and New South Wales watershare. Not one of the New South Wales northern water sharing plans is sustainable in the long term, let alone the short term. That has to change. The demand on all of our rivers from, if you take the critical points, Menindee, where the fish kills were, where in the Murray and the Bidgee, fish breeding is almost non-existent, it's because you aren't getting the critical flows when you need them, and you've got a massive expansion of a particular crop that's probably a third towards its production. So we haven't hit the high yet. If the Goulburn Valley think they're in trouble, then the rest are going to follow very shortly.
Good on you, Howard. Thank you for your thoughts.
On ABC Radio, this is The Conversation Hour with Jonathan Kendall.
Lots of texts coming through on how water has become so politicised in Australia. This one just says simply one word, money. We're going to hear from someone a little bit later this hour about that. Uncle Rick Ronan is a representative of the Yorta Yorta people from Northern Victoria, and he reckons part of the problem is that it's all about money as well. Clint Jasper is still with us, ABC Rural Reporter, and Is it all about money? I mean, is that what this comes down to, where we've got a situation where we've got hedge funds investing in the Australian water system? And another text here saying we've allowed water to become a tradable commodity on international stock exchanges. Australian water rights are being traded on the Singapore Stock Exchange. So is that part of the problem, Clint?
First of all, I would say that's not actually true. You could probably buy shares in a company on the Singapore Stock Exchange that has an investment in Australian Water, but you certainly can't go and buy Australian Water on the Singapore Stock Exchange. And secondly, if we go right back to Federation, we are sharing a diminishing amount of water across three states, multiple users. The Constitution gives states control over water, and they had to, you know, cede by agreement that power to the federal government in an attempt to stop this infighting. If you read the preamble to the Murray-Darling Basin Royal Commission in South Australia, you'll find quotes and grabs from politicians going all the way back to February. Why should these upstream states have to give water to these downstream states? Why should, you know, we share this resource? The bickering has always been there, and it probably always will.
Well, this is just the state of affairs in Australia, isn't it? We've got these state governments that always need to be involved on lots of issues, on coronavirus, on health, on education, on agriculture and on water. So, yeah, it's a bigger issue. But let's bring Scott Hamilton into this discussion. He's an expert in natural resource management and climate change and a member of the Energy Transition Hub at the University of Melbourne. Good morning.
Yes, hello, John Allen Clint. How are you guys?
Oh, very well, very well. What makes water so political in Australia?
Yeah, look, as Clint was saying, that it's always been a hotly contested issue right back since before Federation. But I think that one of the things that's making it really hotly political now in this century is, one, in terms of that climate change is really biting. So in the Murray-Darling Basin alone, in the past 20 years, we've seen a 20-year drop in the inflows compared to the century prior. So that's a huge drop in the amount of inflows going in to the Murray-Darling Basin. And it's also meaning that there's more frequent droughts and they're biting harder. So the farmers, the fishers and all the water users and the environment are all feeling that a lot more. So that's really bringing it to light. And the other thing, if I can just sort of mention the issue about money, I do agree that is a big factor. So we know that annual trading of irrigation water rights is worth about $1.8 billion. And the total value of market value of water rights is currently about $26.3 billion. So these are big numbers, and this is why we do know that there are overseas traders and investors that are buying water. Now they're not going to the Singapore Exchange, but they can come here and purchase water, and that in itself I think is a real problem.
Scott, I wonder your opinion on that because. You know, we heard from clients of, say, Duxton Water during the drought who had entered into long-term lease agreements and were seeing some kind of reprieve from the spikes in prices. So just from a natural resource management point of view, I understand the basin can't be treated like a pipeline. It has natural constraints. But isn't that market mechanism one of the best ways to allocate, you know, the scarce resource?
Well, markets can be useful would be my sort of comment, Clint. But the problem here is, though, it's not farmers that are trying to trade the water, whether it be Duxton versus the dairy farmer in the Goulburn. These are people which can sit over in Wall Street or else in Singapore and be playing the water market here. Now, that's not good for natural resource management. That is only good for making money and money which is leaving our farmers and our communities. So that's fundamentally our problem. And one of the questions just on that, there's been a bit of reports that no one's hoarding water. And there's sort of one of the recent reports that was done, I think, at one of the other states. But that's a bit of a straw man, really, that we know for a fact that 10% of the water is owned by foreign investors, mostly China and the USA. We know the biggest single water owner in Victoria is a Canadian pension fund that's got a $1 company that uses it as a front. So we know that they are there. And the fact is you don't have to have a lot of water to have a big impact on actually manipulating and playing the market.
But PSP Investments, who you've referred to, have a lot of investment in agriculture along the basin as well. So, you know, the water is kind of useless until it's applied to a crop.
Well, let's just dig a little deeper on that as well. So what we really want is the water to go to the best use. So what is going to be the best economic and environmental and social use for the country? Now, if it's just going to where the most money can be made, that's a problem. And the other thing that we found that we also saw when we opened up the water market to all these overseas investors and brokers and traders and didn't put the proper regulation around it, is we saw these sleeper and dozer licences. So these were licences that farmers around the basin had that weren't actually being used. So they were actually sitting there just waiting for the day that the farmer might actually need them. But suddenly, these are worth a lot of money. And as you mentioned before, thousands of dollars. So suddenly, these were on the market and they were being used. So that was another contribution to what's been going wrong with our water market. And Scott, I'll just sort of point to Nick Keogh, who just finished the ACCC report in 2021 that we're still waiting for a response to. And he said that manipulation, he couldn't find it, but the problem was it was so clouded in secrecy and not transparency. And he said that even if it was happened, it wouldn't be illegal.
So that report from the ACCC concluded that the water market had major deficiencies in relation to trader conduct and quality of market information. So is part of the problem here that we don't really have laws against market manipulation of the water market in Australia?
Absolutely. And that's sort of one of the issues. And it's actually fascinating, John and Clint, that we're actually seeing at the moment over in America, and we actually just issued a paper at Melbourne University the last day, that they're going through a major heat wave and major climate change impact. Like, they're breaking records everywhere and they're having major drought as well. And one of the things that we're concerned about, and in fact some of the people in the Colorado Attorney General is too, that they're wanting to go down the same path as what we have here in terms of water market trading. And that means it becomes much more a financial commodity like gold and oil and Bitcoin rather than a really precious natural resource that we nearly have to be really careful about how we share it and how we make sure that it's used to its highest use for economic, environmental and social.
Catherine is in Mansfield and has something to say on this. G'day, Catherine. Go ahead.
Hello, thank you. I think most of the discussion seems to have been very well covered by Scott just then, but I did want to relate an event that happened. A friend of mine attended a retiree's investment advice night in Melbourne, in suburban Melbourne, and the room was full of about 30 to 40 retirees and superannuants, and the investment advisor told them that water was a really good investment, very, very good returns, and that they should be investing in, and the understanding was that it was in the water in the Murray-Darling Basin system. And I just find this is an extraordinary removal of ownership of water from farmers, the environment and communities into the hands of suburban investors.
One thing you do hear a lot when you're talking about who owns water in the basin is that quite often a farmer or an irrigator will consider their water holdings as their superannuation. So it came up a lot in the hearings for that ACCC inquiry as that travelled down the river. But one of the largest groups of people who hold water entitlements are retired dairy farmers.
Yeah, right. And Catherine, did your friend invest in water in the end?
No, at that point, no, she didn't feel she could, in all honour, because she feels that's really wrong.
Fair enough. Thank you for that story. David is in Myree. G'day, David. What's your point?
Well, my concern is that 1 million megalitres of water flows from private land in the upper catchment area into the Murray River. About 500 megalitres flows off my land in an average year. If I want to store any of that water, water that has never left my farm since it fell out of the sky as natural rain, I have to buy a water right from somebody downstream. Otherwise, I cannot store that water. The value of the water off the upper catchment is about $5 billion. That's the total value. All of that's been taken away by legislation without any compensation whatsoever. And it's from the most efficient area to use water. You grow about 3 to 4 times as much grapes, for example, right next door to my farm, with the water that you can grow down further down river, say at Shepparton or down towards Mildura. The efficiency is so much higher, and yet that water has been taken from us without any compensation at all.
Good on you, David. Thank you for that. I'll put that to you, Scott Hamilton. David there in Myree feeling that it's a bit unfair that he has to buy water rights for water that falls on his property. Is that unfair?
Yeah, look, I think that I think we need a fair way of making sure that we're allocating and sharing the water to the best possible way. Now, I think that we do have this issue of what we call the tragedy of the commons. So if everybody is just looking after themselves, the problem then is that the river system and the water system becomes ruined. And that's why we have to make sure that we're not just looking at the individual, but we're looking at the whole system. And I think that's the other thing I'd probably say, is it's not just the individual users, whether they be farmers or fishers or kayakers or else some First Nations people. We have to work out how we all get together to make sure that we're making these decisions that are going to really meet the needs of our whole economy and our whole environment, our whole community.
And has that failed though, Clint? Because, I mean, some people say the Murray-Darling Basin plan is a bit of a mess and it's just failed. Is that a fair assessment?
As I said at the start, we have recovered a significant amount of water from the agriculture side of the ledger and put it to the environmental water holder. So in that sense, it hasn't been a failure. But and I'm also wondering Scott's thoughts on this as well. We do have a much greater understanding of how climate change will impact inflows, and we do have a lot better understanding of, you know, ways that we can use environmental water more efficiently. And so I'm wondering if this steely, headstrong commitment to hitting these targets, despite their, you know, what is now increasing unlikeliness that they'll be achieved in time, is really the most sensible path that we could be on here.
Really, really good question, Clint. Look, I actually think that that it was right to say that the Murray-Darling Basin plan was actually a high point in bipartisanship in terms of really all sides of politics and all states and jurisdictions coming together to look at how we solve the problem. I think that it did have an inbuilt frailty in it, that it didn't address climate change, and that's a real problem, which we're seeing that play out now. And I also think that what we're seeing in terms of those debates about the numbers is we've got to remember that they were really a political compromise in the first place. They weren't really based on the science. So that was really a compromise of what we got there. But what I'm more concerned about, though, is the lack of regulation and the oversight of the water market. Because it doesn't matter what numbers you have, if you're not making sure that it's regulated the way that we would regulate a financial market, so bankers and people, because this is big money we're talking about, then people are going to play the market and work out how they can do the what we would say sort of the American pickers or the Bonnie Doon people, which sort of say with the guy that's using the trading post to work out how they get the most money out of the water. And the problem is if they're doing that just because they're making money, not because they're trying to be irrigators or users or people trying to look after the system, then that's not a fair playing field, and that's one of the fundamental problems.
That's a really important point. Thank you for making that, Scott Hamilton, expert in natural resource management and climate change, and a member of the Energy Transition Hub at the University of Melbourne. And it is big money, Clint. The Murray-Darling Basin produces $24 billion worth of food and fibre every year. So there's a lot in this, including... there is a fair tourism spend on the Murray-Darling Basin as well. I think tourism in the basin is worth $7.5 billion per year as well.
And there's not We do have a very comprehensive, it runs to about 750 pages worth of ACCC findings on the water market and a very detailed stepped out list of reforms that state and federal governments have kind of agreed in principle to in order to address these things. And as you pointed out before, you know, one of the headline findings was that the sophistication of the players in the market has kind of outgrown the strength of the market itself and the structure of the market itself. So it's not a problem that's going ignored, but it is still largely unaddressed.
Yeah, good on you, Clint. Thank you so much for your help this morning and basically co-hosting the conversation now. So I appreciate your time.
So easy.
Clint Jasper, ABC Rural Reporter. And the big question today has been, how has water become such a political issue? Mary is at Tulangada. Morning, Mary.
I'd just like to say there are a lot of problems with the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, and David, who rang from Myrie, and I were both on a committee, and Dom Blackmore told us that the upper catchment people who are providing an awful lot of this water that goes into the Murray River should have been getting a fairer chance, a fairer opportunity in Victoria, because in New South Wales you're allowed to catch 10% of the water that falls on your farm. We're denied any of that, and as David said, if we want to build a dam for irrigation purposes on our farm, we need to buy the water from an irrigator and then wait for it to rain for the dam to fill, because the irrigator is certainly going to supply the water up the Murray River into the catchment.
This just sounds baffling to me, Mary. I mean, when you first heard that, were you just dumbfounded at the state of affairs?
Oh, yes. It was very wrong. And as I said, there was a pretty active committee trying to work to get a chance to use the water. Actually, Pat McNamara suggested we should be able to catch 30%. He came to a meeting at Tarwong Shire and said we should be able to catch 30% of the water that fell on our farms, but was very quickly shut up when he went back to Melbourne. But it has been badly managed too, and I think it hasn't been policed. And, of course, I was saying before I came onto the program that I remembered reading about the climate change in a book by Rachel Castle called Silent Spring, and that was back in the 70s. So the fact that no one was looking at climate change when the plan was drawn up was a bit of a disaster. And the other one is privatising water, because when water belonged to the land and you bought a farm and you had a water allocation with the land, those sleeper licences were really environmental water because they just flowed through. And of course it needed to be changed. People became greedy, wanted more water. I grew up in Old Tulangata, which was flooded to make way for the extension of the Hume Dam, and you know, a lot of people made a lot of sacrifices, and now it's just all about money, not so much about the environment, and the people with the money are getting the water.
So thank you for making that point, because I feel like that's a similar point that Uncle Rick Ronan is going to make, who we've got back on hopefully a much better line. Good morning, Uncle Rick.
Oh, hello.
So, I mean, it's really all about money, isn't it?
Yeah. I look at it as being a commodity of the 21st century, you know, and it's listed on the exchange now. I think a lot of the problems started in the rivers with the growing of the rice. That was the start of it, you know, with the mills at Leeton and Deniliquin and Echuca. You need a lot of water for those to grow that. And it's the same as the cotton. You know, and Cobby Station holds seven times the amount of water as the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Yeah, you know, in certain times of the year, you can walk across it.
And that must be absolutely heartbreaking. You know, when we can walk across such a mighty river as the Murray and you see that degradation. And we will have to let you go there, Uncle Rick. Sorry if the phone lines are against us this morning, but really good to hear from you. And it has been good to hear from you this morning as well about what makes water so political and who should have a say in how it's managed. And there's been a lot of really good points made, particularly around regulation, in that I didn't know that there's no law against market manipulation of the water market in Australia. And that's just from reading this report from the ACCC, concluding that the water market has major deficiencies in relation to trader conduct and quality of market information. And this is important for all of us because it ends up having an effect on when we go to the checkout in the supermarket. It's incredibly important. So that's the Conversation Hour for today. But if you missed the start of this program, or if you know someone who'd be interested in this topic, subscribe to the Conversation Hour podcast on the ABC Listen app, or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, you can email us at conversationhour@abc.net.au. We'd love to hear from you with any suggestions, comments, questions, and ideas for future shows. Thanks for listening. Have a good one.